This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Every week, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to our no-holds-barred forum for discussing what's good, bad, ugly, and just plain silly in the arena of doing business with the government. I'm Mark Amtower. My guests today are two of the regular hosts here on Federal News Radio, Francis Rose from In Depth and Tom Temin from the Federal Drive. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Hello.
How do you do, Mark?
I'm doing great, man. Thank you guys for playing with me today. I want to do something that's just slightly different and kind of a variation on Francis's afternoon Friday afternoon gig. I want to talk about some of the top stories over the last several months and get your opinions on how they impact the market at large and how they impact the contracting community. And we have a slew of stories to start off with, but one that got my attention late last year was the OFPP memorandum basically eliminating the COTR position and rearranging it into the contracting officer's rep position. The idea here seems to be to get some formal training, level one, level two, level three, et cetera. Level one being 8 hours of training with virtually no experience required as a contracting rep. Number one, give me your take on this story and what was wrong with the COTR position.
The problem with the COTR position is there weren't any COTRs to go around. And as a result, a lot of TR work did not get done. I mean, the problem is getting the people in place and getting them to work for the contracting officers and making sure that really happens. The policy is great. It's always good to revise policy, but there was sufficient policy, in my opinion, in place to begin with. What they didn't have is the people and the will, apparently, to carry it out where it was needed, especially in the overseas contingency contracting.
The agencies obviously are struggling with getting people to be able to do contracting. And the biggest thing that people are telling me is they're having a hard time keeping people, getting them to stay. The ranks of the contracting officers at the agencies, those are the folks that are interested in buyouts or just going to work for contractors to be able to sell their knowledge back to the government. So that seems to be the biggest thing. I'm not sure I see a whole lot here that addresses that problem.
No, and the shortage of 1102s is definitely where I wanted to go with this. With this being an election year, the driving force being downsized government, who on the Hill outside of a small handful really understand that we need not only to replenish the 1102 Corps, but get them better trained and get them deployed as quickly as possible? Who's out there pushing this on the Hill?
Well, the Hill is pushing a lot of procurement regulations, especially small business. There's about seven bills competing from the Small Business Committee and its various subdivisions to get increased small business attention in the federal government. But I think the Hill understands they need good contracting officers and good training. But right now, there's just not money for anything that's discretionary.
Well, and I'm not sure the Hill understands, Tom, what that means. I don't think anybody denies that, yes, we want the government to be good at contracting, at procuring the goods and services that they need. But what's involved with that and what's required to make that happen is what it seems to me there's a lack of on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, and you know, the Federal Acquisition Institute is where they want to train the new COR core, if you will. But as a marketing guy, one of the questions that I got on a regular basis and still get occasionally, because people don't know there are no COTRs, was how do I find these people? What do they want to hear from me when we're trying to influence them prior to the RFP process?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I, you know, there was never an official job designation. There's no OPM designation for COTR. You're just kind of, you know, somebody waved a wand, go poof, you're it for the next 6 months. And
Well, I think it was good to take the technical out of it, although sometimes they have to be technically good. But, you know, a lot of times federal agencies used IV&V contractors as kind of a form of COTR, independent verification and validation. But, yeah, there, if you take the technology out and just make it contractors, officers, representative, that implies a whole lot of other range of issues they can look at for contracting, such as finance and adherence to schedule and the project management and all those other things that affect whether a contractor delivers on time. But, yeah, it should be a fun, exciting job, someone who likes sleuthing. But maybe, you know, it's like federal contracting itself should be exciting. When you think about what's required to really execute and then follow through on delivery of a complicated federal contract, it's a high degree of intellectual and creative work is required. But I think often people don't realize that.
Well, I think the government doesn't do as good a job as it could at explaining what kind of people they're looking for and then figuring out where those people are and going and finding them and talking about the reasons why a career in this particular aspect of government work is a desirable career. You know, we're looking at this story that Jason Miller did on this, and you outlined the level one requirement. Level two is 40 hours of training and 1 year of previous COR experience. Level three, 60 hours of training, 2 years of COR experience. But what kind of person is behind that? What kind of college training do they have? What kind of other work experience do they have? What kind of personality do they have? What kind of human being does that job? It seems to be very amorphous. It seems like there's not a profile, I guess, of the kind of person that the government's going for. You think that's true, Tom?
I agree completely. If it says, COR experience required on contracts of moderate to high complexity that require significant acquisition investment, that's the level three. Mm-hmm. I mean, the language is pretty highfalutin. But yeah, it's like someone... Is it the same type of person that goes to a farm and inspects cattle for the agriculture department? Or is it someone that works for NASA and looks to see how well a satellite is being assembled? It's unclear beyond just the technical requirements of level 1, 2, 3, what is the real skill needed.
Well, I think your point, Tom, about the different kinds of skills that are used and how you make it sound like almost an artistic, really creative kind of thing, which it is. And I'm certainly not suggesting that you're misleading anyone in that, because you're not. But do you then try to make people who have an accounting background interested in that kind of thing? I'm not sure that's a really good match. And Mark, I don't think anybody's really getting a sense of what the government's going to do beyond throw up openings on usajobs.gov and hope somebody catches the line.
Yeah, I'd like to see a little more thought go behind this. Like, anybody in the 1102 Corps has probably been through some NCMA classes, National Contract Management Association. I would like to see some of those types requirements go to the COR, and even for both of them to go through some APMP, the Association of Proposal Management Professionals, to see what it's like to work on both sides. Because if they understand the problems that contractors face reading a proposal, maybe they'll be able to put together requirements that are more clearly enunciated.
Well, that's right. They could help with requirements formation. But at some point, you do need technology knowledge if someone is developing a satellite for you, or if they're creating a software program that involves significant coding and programming. At some point, somebody's got to look at what's going on there that understands what is going on there. Mm-hmm. And those people are, fewer and fewer and far between that work for the federal government. There are some, but they are fewer and far between than they were 25 years ago.
Right, but if you have some, if you have a vehicle coming down the pike that it has a heavy cyber component, it would be nice to have your COR have some modicum of CISS training behind them, or even a CISSP behind them, as well as a little bit of contracting.
Yeah, and that's why finance might be something important in certain situations, because someone that does know the technicals of a particular discipline or a vertical domain within a bundle of things required to execute on a contract, it's harder for a contractor to either kid them, or it's easier for them to spot anomalies the contractor may themselves not be aware of.
Very cool. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. When we come back, we are going to dissect yet another story from the last couple of months.
Life's big decisions require some research. You get comparison reports before you buy a car. You hire an inspector when buying a house. You might even look up someone online before a date. But when you go to pick your primary care physician, sometimes you only get a name and number. That hardly seems fair. After all, the only person who has more influence on your health is you. It's different at Kaiser Permanente. All our doctors are listed online with information that paints a picture of who they are, so you know you're picking a doctor who is right for you, right for your family, and someone you can email. Oh, here's one for Dr. Amy Benoulis, who went to Northwestern. Dr. Lindsay Strickland is interested in chronic disease management and is accepting new patients. Bingo! Become a member, and no matter whom you choose, you get a true advocate for your health. So log on to kp.org/doctor and check us out. It could be the beginning of a healthy relationship. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated. 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Giving you the edge on healthy living, here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge.
Never thought that I would ever hear the word cancer in my vocabulary.
But Teresa Narveson did get cancer, a diagnosis of early stage breast cancer for which she had a lumpectomy and radiation. Then
my primary care doctor said, you're pre-diabetic with all your blood count numbers.
The news prompted Teresa to make changes. She walks every day and makes healthy food choices.
The evidence is amazing for what weight loss and exercise has done to decrease breast cancer recurrence.
Dr. Sandhya Pruthi says research shows many cancers are fueled by estrogen, and estrogen is stored in fat. So by losing weight, you may decrease your risk of breast cancer coming back, and you decrease the risk of developing a new breast cancer. Dr. Pruthi recommends all her patients try to maintain a healthy weight. By doing this, you can cut your risk of many diseases, including breast cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Tracy McRae.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Creating the United States, a Library of Congress exhibition about the nation's founding documents, will close on Saturday, May 5th. This must-see exhibition centers on the creation of the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. The exhibition is free and open to the public, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Saturday in the library's Thomas Jefferson Building at 10 First Street Southeast, Washington, D.C. Don't miss it. For more information, visit loc.gov.
Adobe Acrobat Pro is actually used very commonly for PDF archiving. If you've got a lot of files of different formats and different types, if you just save these files in all these different formats, then 20 years later, somebody wants to look at the file, they'd actually have to have the program that could open up that file. So for digital archiving, you'd rather have a standardized file format.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The Washington Business Journal is seeking nominations for its sixth annual CFO of the Year Awards, recognizing CFOs and other financial executives in the Washington area for their outstanding performance as corporate financial stewards. Are you or someone you know a CFO star? Nominate them online at WashingtonBusinessJournal.com/nomination. Deadline is fast approaching. Save the date for the award ceremony, Thursday, July 19th at the Omni Shoreham Hotel.
Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guests today are Tom Temin, host of the Morning Drive. Tom, if you don't know, is also a hell of a writer, and I believe you do occasionally take some writing gigs. Is that accurate?
I do, yeah. Some technical writing. I call it corporate writing.
You do write white papers, too.
I write white papers. I do a lot of things that nobody knows. I wrote.
Yeah.
you don't know why I wrote them.
No, but I mean, you know, your clients do, and they fund you accordingly. And my other guest today is Francis Rose. And Francis, you know, I tell people this. I think I wrote it on your LinkedIn profile. You have the voice to die for. You know, if I did radio every day, I'd kill you just for your voice box.
It doesn't really work that way, but I appreciate the sentiment.
Doesn't?
No.
See, I'm a marketing guy. I'm not a technical guy.
Obviously.
I'd be a crappy COR, wouldn't I? Another story from last year that has amused me constantly is the concept of inherently governmental. If there was ever an Orwellian phrase, this has to be it. But, you know, again, it's one of Jason's stories. And what is it? And if there are things that are inherently governmental and they have to be brought back into government, we're downsizing government, you know, just like the 1102s and the CORs. Is this one great big happy hour of catch 22?
No, I don't think so. I think when Dan Gordon, when he was at OFPP, took this issue on, I think that I don't think there was that much inherently governmental work actually being done by contractors. I think there was a little bit of politics here because I think the administration wanted to help out the unions, the public employee unions, who probably did feel that some of the inherently governmental work was being done. But all they did with their new final guidance was kind of reinforce guidance that had been longstanding, 40, 50, 60 years of guidance. There was no real new ground broken here. It was just a redefinition for people, like, well, if you're playing chess, no, you can't move the knight that way, and you did move the knight that way, maybe in a few instances. But inherently governmental is kind of easy to spot. It's one of those things, you know it when you see it. We don't use mercenaries. You have to, if you're firing a bullet on behalf of the United States, you have to be an employee.
I'm sorry, does that include Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, all right. Maybe that, you got me on that one. Yeah, providing security, they did fire some bullets on behalf of the federal government, and they did not work for the federal government. So, all right, well, let's try another one. Writing a check on behalf of the federal government. If you're going to commit funds, that's inherently governmental.
Yeah. But yeah, and we use a government computer to do it. I don't think anybody
actually saw it. Yeah, Nisource Square, that's the one that did us in here.
As I looked at this, Mark, what I thought was funny was, how many times now, I was trying to count back and think back, how many times we've now had final guidance on inherently governmental. I mean, this is, I can think of at least three that since I've been covering the federal government. I haven't been doing it nearly as long as you have, Tom. And I wonder over the course of the next decade or 15 years, how many more times we'll get final guidance on inherently governmental.
Well, inherently governmental is kind of like data center consolidation. Early on in the current administration's data consolidation effort, I did try to find a memo that had come out from the White House early on. It was around 2009 sometime when Vivek Kundra launched this whole thing. And what I found when I searched, what came up was a 1995 I think it was Alice Rivlin memo came up on the exact same topic from OMB way back during the Clinton administration with almost the same language, the same numbers. There were 2,000 data centers then. There's 2,000 data centers at the time Vivek Kundra started. And, of course, they did consolidate then. The kudzu grew again, and they're reconsolidating. So, yes, your point's well taken, Francis. These things do come around.
And the I think inherently governmental is also like the Supreme Court definition of pornography. You know, we'll know it when we see it. And everybody decides differently what they think inherently governmental is. So I imagine if the president's reelected, we have another OFPP administrator confirmed, whether it's Ms. Field or somebody else, they'll have new guidance. And it might not be, Tom, as you mentioned, dramatically different than what we've seen before. But if somebody else is elected president and a new OFPP administrator comes in that administration, we might see something that is dramatically different, as we did when President Bush came into office and Angela Stiles came in at OFPP.
Yeah. Your comment on "we'll know it when we see it" reminds me of an attorney general who had to cover up a statue before he had a press conference. Uh-huh. It's, you know, the definitions can be pretty disparate, and you know it when
and
you
desperate.
See it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know it when we see it is a cheap out, frankly.
But I think just to be fair to OFPP and Dan Gordon, I mean, they did try to reestablish some baselines and understandings, and sometimes those things do need to be reset periodically just so we kind of snap back. It's like snapping back to the Constitution, which tends to get forgotten in some of the arguments occasionally.
Right. And I did not choose this story to make fun of Mr. Gordon, for whom I have respect. And frankly, I don't have respect for everybody who held that position.
One of the things that's come out of this conversation, too, that I think is really noteworthy is nobody has ever proposed codifying a definitive list. And it may not be possible, but everybody that I've asked about this, hey, why don't we just make a list and get a group of people from both sides of the aisle to negotiate this out and agree that this is going to be our list? And nobody seems to want to do that, and I'm not sure why exactly.
Well, maybe because things change over time.
Do they change that dramatically, though, that you couldn't say
certain activities? Yeah.
This list is definitive. We could add things later, but this list is definitely definitive.
Yeah, the only way something comes off the list is if it disappears.
Yes, exactly.
And well, they do have, you know, Jason's story did list some of the bullets on there, all combat, security operations and situations connected with combat or potential combat, determination of an offer's price reasonableness, and so on. So there is a list, but the application of that list may change.
Yeah, but we know that first item was not valid with, you know, Blackwater or whoever they're called now.
Well, that was actually protection of civilians in the State Department in security. So that wasn't really combat.
But they were shooting. They were shooting in a combat zone.
Tom, you're exactly right about Jason's list, and it's listed here in this story. But immediately after that, Gordon said the new list of inherently governmental positions is about 90% to 95% the same as the previous one.
Yeah.
In the FAR, that means that 5% to 10% of it is different. Which, if I think, is a significant amount for a list like this that's supposed to be pretty stable.
Well, things happen over the centuries. I mean, they, you know, maybe is flying a spacecraft, you know, to the moon. Should that be inherently governmental? They couldn't have imagined that, you know, in the 40s and 50s. So,
well, and that's to my point that you could add jobs to the list.
Yeah.
But subtracting them out would be a different and more. A more deliberate process than just, we should add that one. And a lot of people can agree that in a United States of America spacecraft, we don't want some contractor flying it. We want an astronaut who's gone through NASA's astronaut training program. Agreed. You have a hard time finding an argument about that. Some of the things that are at lower levels than that, it seems to me it would be hard to argue those in or out.
I mean, I remember a time when you saw lawns being mowed on the mall, mm-hmm. lawns being mowed at a federal facility anywhere. It was done by federal employees.
Right.
When I was a kid and we used to visit the museums and they all had these great cafeterias in the basement, the employees in the cafeterias were cooking food right there. They weren't bringing it in on a truck and they worked for the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You know, that's all gone away too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was not only pretty good food, it was pretty damn cheap.
That's right, unlike what it is now.
Those were the days. Francis wasn't around then.
And you could walk up the Washington Monument and wander between the Treasury and the White House. A lot of things you could do in Washington at one time.
Walk right into the Capitol building and just walk around.
Yep. Well, yeah, prior to, and this show is actually going to air the day after, April 19th is the date that I'm looking for. The week this show airs is the Oklahoma City week. From 95.
Yeah, profound change.
Yeah, profound change. Prior to that, all you had to do was go to OPM, get a phase card, and you could access virtually any, at least federal civilian building. And phase card is just showing them a driver's license or some form of identification. They took your picture, put it on a card, said official U.S. government visitor or something like that, and you'd go in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, luckily, you can still walk into the Russell and get a haircut on the Senate side.
Well, there you go. We're going to start with our third story here, but we're going to cut it short and carry it over to the next segment. Mythbusters 2. I find this vastly amusing, again, because it's supposed to improve the ability to communicate between contractors and government. And the I believe our following story is going to talk about waste, fraud, and abuse. So there's some irony here.
Mm-hmm.
Mythbusters 2.
Well, it's a good idea.
Great idea.
The industry wants it. The agencies say they want it, but industry people tell me that they're not really seeing much out of Mythbusters 1. Dan Gordon tried really hard and had a great idea, but you can't make people change their minds, and you can't make people change the way that they do things. And ultimately, it seems to me that one of the very most basic human responses to any kind of stimulus is to CYA. And that's ultimately why MythBusters has not been any more successful than it's been.
That's right. When Senator Metzenbaum's son-in-law was OFPP chief, I'm talking about Steve Kelman, he did the same thing, initiated the more oral presentations and rapid down selects, but he did it in a way, he reinforced an existing policy in a way that was dramatic, had all those contracting officers come into the Indian Treaty Room and stand up like Boy Scouts and kind of pledge to use these different tools. So just like contracting officer representatives and inherently governmental, each generation tries to put its stamp and renew policy. But the FAR has oral discussions and pre-solicitation discussions. It's all in the FAR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as you said, Francis, people are afraid to use it because it's a risk-averse culture.
Well, that's partly our fault, Tom, to be honest with you. I mean, it's the reaction is because they don't want to get caught doing something that looks bad. Even if they have the cover of saying, well, it's not in the FAR, so the rule is that if it's not in the FAR, I should be able to do it. That's not good enough for folks who are trying to catch them doing something bad.
Yeah, but I'd have to disagree with you slightly there in that, frankly, what we do on Federal News Radio and what some of the trade pubs do as well is catch people doing things right. And we do highlight that, and they don't get much play elsewhere.
Wasn't there a comedian on television many years ago? Nobody told me that I couldn't XYZ, so I did. And so that's kind of the opposite of what happens in the government. Nobody told me that I could, so I don't dare.
Uh-huh. There you go. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. When we come back, we are going to dissect yet another story.
Inova Fairfax Hospital for Children is Northern Virginia's only children's hospital, providing extra special care for our region's littlest patients. Each day, they help premature babies thrive, cure the tiniest of hearts, and beat childhood cancers. Help Inova heal our region's children. Join the Inova Fairfax Hospital for Children at the Star Kid 8K on April 22nd. Proceeds support Inova's pediatric heart programs. To learn more and register, go to inova.org/8K.
Arming your home with a security system gives you peace of mind. Now get peace of mind for your wallet. Ackerman Security will monitor your system for $18.95 a month.
I was paying too much for monitoring, so I made the switch to Ackerman Security's Certified Monitoring Center. Now I'm paying only $18.95 a month with no cost to switch.
Call today and get 2 months of Ackerman's award-winning basic monitoring free. 888-999-1070, AckermanSecurity.com.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does 3 decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
Johnny Holiday for the Memorial Day Festival for Wounded Warriors at Great Meadow, home of the Gold Cup in Plains, Virginia. May 27th, a spectacular event is being staged for Wounded Warriors. Music, air show, and fun for the family. Free barbecue, beer, wine tasting, and more. To sponsor a tent, go to bfwwt.org or call 301-296-4408. For a limited time only, tickets are free. 301-296-4408 or go to bfwwt.org.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on 1500 AM at 10 AM. Please join me this week for my special guest, John Agri, who is president and CEO of a new startup called BizGravity, an online auction marketplace for executives. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out,
when someone gives blood and a life is saved. That moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
A problem with tapping wind energy is finding space for those huge turbines. But there may be a solution thanks to an unlikely source. Fish. Wind turbines are usually spaced far apart so they don't interfere with each other. But John DeBeery, a Caltech engineer, says a more compact arrangement might not only save space but allow the turbines to work together. He points to schooling fish.
As they swim, they generate vortices, these swirling currents in their wake, and those vortices will interact to help reduce the energy requirements of the whole school of fish.
Computer models show how to precisely place wind turbines for a similar effect.
As the wind is flowing past one of these wind turbines, in certain directions, it's actually accelerated and directed toward the neighbors.
DeBeery says this could allow wind farms closer to cities, where electricity is needed most. To find out more, go to nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guests today are Francis Rose and Tom Temin, both staples here at Federal News Radio. You can find all of this stuff at federalnewsradio.com. Let me tell you, if you go to federalnewsradio.com and just click on the shows, we archive everything here for a year. There's a ton of information that you can find. Most of it on my show. Just kidding, guys. You know, every time I listen, and you know, when I'm driving in the morning, driving in the afternoon, there I'm always picking up G2. This is good stuff. This is not a commercial, but it's a fact. You know, we highlight good news in the government, good programs. We highlight bad news in the government, bad programs. So we're going to hit one of those. Not yet. Well, maybe. Suspension, debarment, fraud, waste, and abuse. Go out and find bad things. Publicize them. Send them to O'Hara at the Post. what the hell's going on here?
Well, I think that suspension, debarment, you know, that's another tool that has not been used very heavily. But I think that one of the reasons it has not been used very heavily is the complexity of the FAR itself and the situations that the federal government finds itself in. I mean, every so often you see a press release that one of the large contractors, the Lockheeds and the Northrops, that size of contractor, pays a $15 million fine for a pricing issue that happened 5 years ago. Oracle got caught up in this kind of thing. And when you really scratch the surface, very often the company itself discovered the problem. Or maybe the government did and the company had a dispute about it, but it's an honest disagreement, or it might have been an administrative error. There's no criminal intent. There's no right. Frauding intent. But things get so complicated, pricing mechanisms and pricing assurances get very technical, that it's possible in a company of a couple hundred thousand people or whatever they might be, that somebody made a error, coded something wrong, and the government was overcharged.
Or in the case of some of the companies, you know, somebody from a commercial division gives a banking institution which spends massive amounts of money, they give them a price break on one product, and all of a sudden that applies back X number of years.
Well, that's right. And so it's easy to get caught. And I think the government is reluctant. They want to make it right. They'll take the money and take the payment. But I think they're reluctant to use these heavy tools like suspension and debarment. They want to save it for where there's obvious fraud and deception and, you know, bad intent. And I think maybe that's the issue of why it's not used so much. And again, why does OFPP, why have they been pushing for this? I don't really know, because I think...
Well, I think they've been pushing for it because Congress has been pushing for it. And the idea of how this looks on the Hill looks to me more like just scalp collection than it does anything else. Mm-hmm. Members of Congress want to be able to say to the people in their districts or states, hey, we're going after those big, bad old government contractors, and my efforts or my committee's efforts resulted in X number of companies. Is that really constructive, helpful to the taxpayer ultimately and to the operation of the government? I don't think so. But newsflash, Congress does something for political reasons. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. And some of the big companies, the well-known names, are going to try hard not to get into that situation mm-hmm. because they have a lot at stake. Usually the real criminal companies that try to do business with the government are fly-by-nights and, you know,
well,
former...
You got that Medicaid doctor who filed, what, 25,000 cases a week?
Yeah, right.
You know, take him out and shoot him. There's an example.
That might be overdoing it a little bit.
I bet nobody else would do it after that for a while.
They tried it in China, and they had no more bad milk.
I'm not even sure how to respond to that.
You know, putting hard time behind those things would help. So when something is that obvious and that egregious, okay, that was definitely fraud on a massive scale.
Yeah. What I think is interesting is we don't uncover that many examples of that, though.
No, but when we do, the mainstream media, USA Today with the salaries, the Washington Post with alleged influence peddling things, very little rubber hits the road in those stories. But yet they're major headlines mm-hmm. for, you know, how long?
Well, once in a while, there is a real case. But yeah, I mean, I would make the same analogy to what's happening at GSA, you know, with the party and the conference that cost $800,000 and lots of huge fallout there. People lost jobs, careers, and reputations mm-hmm. ruined over, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the same Congress that has been regularly letting out information about that and garnering great headlines and feigning great outrage. I mean, they do watch as $780 billion in deficit was accumulated in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
And there's no outrage going on from the same Congress that's worried about whether the hors d'oeuvres were overpriced.
Well, it's not. But
that the hors d'oeuvres should be overpriced.
You had a guest on this morning. We're recording this Friday. Your guest this morning from GPO, the head of GPO.
The superintendent of documents.
Right, yeah. And she was talking about, you know, when the Titanic sunk, a hearing was held the next week, and it was wrapped up in 4 weeks, and recommendations were made.
And those recommendations are still in place in maritime operations to this very day.
100 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean...
And a lot of the information, a lot of the basis for all of the myths and legends about, you know, first-class drownings and second-class drownings, those are all in the original Senate document from a month after the sinking. You know, what I said that during that interview was today it would take 6 months to convene a panel, and then it would be another 18 months till they discovered what happened and issued recommendations.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Tom. I mean, the first hearing about the General Services Administration situation is going to be 2 weeks after we learned about the IG report initially. That's not bad turnaround time.
Yeah, and the National Transportation Safety Board usually collects its data while the situation is still smoldering,
mm-hmm.
usually. But you know, nowadays, just things are more complicated, I think, than they were in those days.
That's for sure.
It's hard to arrange a junket to some of these things. You can't. Well, actually, they probably could go to what was the resort M something.
Yes, the M Resort in Henderson, Nevada.
I'm sure that there'll be a congressional inquiry party visiting that site to.
I don't know about that. I think that might just be such bad form that even Congress can't get away with it.
I don't know that form exists.
Well, it's just, you know, these things all have to be taken in context, and it's a matter of balance. And, you know, Congress should look at this, and GSA does need to examine itself in these situations. But it's just, I think sometimes perspective gets lost in the thrill of what happens.
Yeah. And we are definitely going to look at the at the PBS issue in some depth on the next segment. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Here's Adrian Gardner, CIO of NASA Goddard, on the Federal Executive Forum on Big Data, sponsored by Informatica.
The issue really now, we'll be able to visualize the data more like infographics and help make sense of scale and data points in ways that we have never thought of in the past. The other one is sort of a societal kind of impact I'll see is I think there will be winners and losers economically.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Government leaders have one thing in common. They know data is their biggest asset, but that asset is growing exponentially. Data is expected to grow by as much as 44 times over the next year to a staggering 35.2 zettabytes. Welcome to the era of big data. How will your agency effectively process the volume of data to support missions, serve citizens, and provide the right information to the right individuals? Informatica helps government agencies to move, take in, and manage their data, regardless of how much, what kind, or where it is. Visit Informatica.com. How is the U.S. Government Accountability Office working to put the country on a sustainable fiscal path? What is GAO doing to assist Congress and ensure accountability to the American people? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with his very special guest, Gene Dodaro, Comptroller General of the United States and head of the U.S. Government Accountability Office, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma. Or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible. March for Babies! Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
The White House defiantly says it has no intentions of ending CIA drone strikes against militant targets in Pakistan. And this is possibly a setup for new tensions between the U.S. and Pakistan, specifically after Pakistan's parliament unanimously approved new guidelines calling for the U.S. to cease and desist drone strikes. Continuing the drone strikes might extend the blockade on U.S. and NATO supplies into Afghanistan. I'm J.J. Green.
We see the hiker. He appears injured.
Every day, the Army and National Guard take to the skies in their newest helicopter, the UH-72A Lakota from EADS North America. Whether for medical evacuation, search and rescue, or emergency response, the Lakota ensures our armed forces complete the mission.
Hiker is secure.
And every Lakota's been delivered on time and on budget.
ETA, 30 minutes.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Disabled American Veterans is dedicated to one single purpose, building better lives for America's disabled veterans. May 18th through the 20th, in the company of the vintage B-25 Mitchell Bomber, DAV brings its message of support for veterans to the Joint Base Andrews Air Show. In its modern-day mission with DAV, the B-25 serves as a reminder of the sacrifices veterans make for freedom. Meet the DAV flight team with the B-25 at the Joint Base Andrews Air Show.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
Federal News Radio supports GITEC's Shared IT Services Summit May 20th through 22nd in Baltimore. The summit will focus on comprehensive examples of government agencies delivering and using shared IT services, and will feature presentations from government IT visionaries such as U.S. CIO Stephen Van Roekel, DHS CIO Richard Spires, and many more. Registrations open to government and industry IT executives. Government employees attend for free, so sign up now at GITEC.org.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Anna Galindo Maroney is chief of the Hatch Act Unit at the Office of Special Counsel.
Federal employees cannot engage in political activity directed at the success or failure of a candidate or campaign, and that would include using not only their government email account or their government computers, but also their own personal gadgets, whether it's their smartphone, their iPad, or any other similar item.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guests today are two friends, guys I've known a long time. Tom Temin, I've known since you came to town to run Government Computer News and migrated over here, which was a very cool move. And Francis Rose, who, when he came to Federal News Radio, he was my producer for a while, you know, because I can't run anything here.
I did come in and help you get everything set up. Yes,
there you go. And believe me, greatly appreciated. I'm in my sixth year. God, who'd have thunk?
You don't look a day over five.
Yeah, well, there you go. I don't act a day over five.
And boy, are my arms tired.
All right, next story, and one that's been beaten to death, but I want to take a slightly different tack on it. The Public Building Service, we touched on this, the Henderson, Nevada Resort M, whatever the heck that place is. I pass up on speaking gigs because I simply will not go to Vegas. I can't do it.
Well, Las Vegas has a couple of advantages we should point out. One, you can get very inexpensive, reasonably priced venues there. They mm-hmm. do exist.
Yeah.
And some of the fancy places off season are pretty cheap too.
Yep.
And also the airfare is probably as good to that city as it is to Chicago.
Yep.
And so it's an easy place to get in one plane from almost everywhere. So
Nevada subsidizes the airlines to offer direct and cheap flights.
That's the part of this that stumped me is you could have probably at this point in time, and let's think back. For an event in 2010, you would have started to plan it in 2009, right in the middle of the very worst of the economic crisis. So you could have made, at that point in time, I think, a very legitimate business case why you would want to go to Southern Nevada, which was one of the hardest hit areas by that economic crisis, if you would have taken the time to do it. Now, there's no indication in the Inspector General's report that anybody did, but how long could that step have taken where you could just collect information and say, all right, it would cost us this much to put this on in San Francisco, and it would cost us this much to put it on in San Diego, and this much to put it on in Denver. But wait a minute. Because of the current economic situation, we can get a terrific bargain by doing it in this particular area and then narrow it down and at least give yourself a little bit of cover.
Yeah, the problem here is that not that the conference or the idea of a conference or training has no value. It's simply that the costs were excessive on this particular one.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly where I want to take this. The purpose of this purportedly was best practices in facilities management. Well, there's an International Facilities Management Association that hosts events on this on a regular basis. It's like $600 for a three or four-day event. And I know that they would do a on their national thing, a best practices for managing public facilities.
The problem here is that the idea of people traveling to get together for a face-to-face conference for training has been tarred by the fact that one training conference was done in excessive cost.
Right.
And it could have been done cheaper.
I want to touch on one more story before we wrap this up today. And Francis, it goes back to several times I've heard on your show, your reference to the event where Mr. Kunder brought up for the first time the BYOD.
Yes, it was an AFSEA Bethesda breakfast, and I'm gonna guess that it was.
I was the moderator of that breakfast.
Were you really?
Yeah.
See how great my memory is? I don't even remember that.
What a great way to wrap it up.
He said, "Let people bring their own devices, and we'll provision them for
yes.
you, or so give you some kind of a monthly allowance for a data plan for that device."
Mm-hmm. And my observation that AmTower is referring to, Tom, is sitting in the audience. I saw the CIOs and CISOs in the audience; their faces all went white, and the vendors all started just slobbering. Just thinking about the idea of what they could sell to the government.
And that's right. And it's been popular to talk about the security problems of BYOD because of these iOS and Android OS devices. In my opinion, that problem is largely solved. And it can be, the military even is solved. They're trying to speed up the process by which they approve devices. The real issues are much deeper. Are the costs really lower? How do you manage wireless access and wireless plans, and how do you divide between personal use and government use of these devices? Does the government pay for the device, or does the person pay for the device? And that complicates the issue of who has rights to use different applications on it. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot more policy work way beyond security that is the issue that they haven't really confronted yet.
I talked to an expert not too long ago who doesn't do business with the government and isn't trying to do business with the government. So theoretically, no dog in this fight. And his position was, according to the research he'd done, this is the Aberdeen Group is the name of this organization. And their position is, their research indicates it could cost about 40% more for agencies to run BYOD programs than it would to purchase their own infrastructure and distribute their own devices to employees. I don't have an opinion, agree or disagree, but the idea that you're going to do BYOD and save a whole bunch of money, the jury's still way out on that, it seems to me.
The jury is still very much way out on that. And you can provide modern devices and still have the government own them. It could be an iPad, if that's what you want, instead of a regular notebook computer. The other issue that hasn't been fully vetted here is the applications. If you, I mean, we're talking about touchscreen devices. When they say BYOD, nobody means bring your own Osborne, you know, or bring your own, you know, 10-pound laptop. They mean bring your own iPod, iPhone, Android phone, et cetera, et cetera. Uh-huh. Few people still want BlackBerries. And so that means that enterprise applications that look like something you sit in front of a computer and touch have to be recompiled or changed to work on those devices, the front ends anyway, and also have to be friendly to a touchscreen interface. And that's a that's going to be a big cost when you get into all the applications that people could use remotely.
We talked about the GSA a few minutes ago, and one of the things that they do that they don't get a lot of attention for is they are desperately trying to put together a smart, flexible mobile strategy that any agency can use. And desperately is probably a bad word because they're doing a good job of it. The agencies don't seem to want to just take the tools that, that the Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies is putting together for them. Agencies are going around talking about, we're going to create an app store for our employees to use. Well, they have one already. Why not participate in something that's already built instead of building your own? So my fear about BYOD is that it's going to go into this pot of elements of mobile computing that agencies just are not quite sure what to do about, and so it's going to get kind of half-hearted attention, and the CIO is going to be distracted by cybersecurity and other technology issues in the agency, and it'll get assigned to somebody, and then we're going to wind up with 25 or 30 or 60 people, one at every agency of any significant size at all, that are going to be tasked with mobile. None of them will talk to each other. None of them will interact with each other, and we'll see the same thing with this that we've seen with any other, any number of other technological issues over the years.
Yeah, like telework.
Yeah,
this reminds
same thing.
Me. This reminds me of you know, mechanics. If you were an automobile mechanic, maybe still true, you had to come to a job at this station or that garage with your own tools.
Yep.
Because the garages didn't provide, and that's why you see the Snap-on trucks going all over
yep.
the place to
still
replace individual people's tools. We're going to have a Snap-on for federal BYOD.
Well, and that's why, to go back to the event that we talked about, that's why the vendors were drooling, because they knew they could potentially be the Snap-on guy. And it doesn't matter. You know, my dad was in that business. There was a Snap-on guy, and there was two or three other brands that would go around to the shops, and they competed against each other. And so there was at least that element of competition.
Your dad was the guy with the 2x4s with nails sticking up in it, right? For the other trucks.
There you go. Gentlemen, I'd love to continue this, but we are out of time. Thank you very much for joining me today. This is not my day job. I am a consultant in the government market. Look for me on LinkedIn. Join the Government Market Master Group and find out about our new program in conjunction with Capital College. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, Monday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.